You're listening to Beyond Casterbus. I'm Christian Corley. He's James McLean. Hello, James.
Hello.
Hello. It's you join us, dear listener, in the middle of a different conversation. We're going to try and get up to speed with what's going on. We're kind of beholden to Facebook for this. And I must admit, I was having some very, very childish giggles a few moments ago, James, because I was just trying to bring up the poll that the discussion that I initiated on Facebook earlier, which we'll get to in a moment, when I discovered a post. I subscribe to a group called Slow Cooked Wonders for recipe ideas, and Americans will be dismayed by what's about to follow. The post was, any ideas of what to do with faggots in the slow cooker, please? Because we have this massive cultural gap, despite the fact that we speak the same language as the Americans, mostly. We have words that mean completely different things. So, just to clarify, faggots are like meatballs, but made from pig liver and pig heart and bacon and herbs and breadcrumbs, and they're like meatballs, like I say. I'm just reading the comments on this thread, just making me laugh so much a few minutes ago for very childish reasons. But it is you know, one of the core philosophies of comedy is you know, it's misunderstanding, it's confusion, it's misinterpretation. And this is like one of the absolute epitomes of real life misinterpretation of a single word.
So
chuckling inanely, it is very funny. It's just silly. It's very silly. It's very silly. I think probably the lesson to be learned is, never go to America if you smoke. Never go to America and ask someone if you can bum a fag. Because it's not the thing to say.
But to clarify, that is actually a phrase people use.
To get a cigarette off someone, yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
It's not one that you've contrived to make.
Not at all, no.
So saying that is a phrase that people will use without any sort of connotations to it, yeah, either. So
other than like having a cigarette.
Yeah.
Yeah. It may indeed be the lead up to something else later on, but initially it's to get a cigarette.
But even as a phrase, it's not a phrase that's constructed around the trappings, which it could be interpreted for, is what I think is kind of interesting. Even though people would, if they broke it down, see the connotations that other cultures would see in it, because those words still resonate in our language as well. We know what fag means to, or can mean derisively to Americans. We know what bum obviously means. So the phrase should, in theory, carry those connotations, but it doesn't. When people say it, they don't think of it in that way at all. It's really weird.
It is. Do you know, while we're talking about linguistics and things, in a roundabout sort of
way,
there was this we've talked a lot from a Doctor Who angle. We talked a lot on the podcast with the K about at least more than once, of Doctor Who possibly moving to Manchester.
Yeah,
and there's been this news today that there are some extras jobs are being advertised in Manchester for Doctor Who. Although conversely, this comes just a couple of days after a job closed for a new script editor for Doctor Who, which was clearly based in Wales. And it got me thinking about rumours. Because one thing we tend to ignore about rumours, they are very much moments in time, aren't they? A rumour from 6 months ago is completely different to a rumour now, even if it's about the exact same thing.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they are the moments in time. They also go through a bit of a Chinese whispers sort of a thing. And a rumour that's going to be Doctor Who's moving to Manchester 6 months ago could be something completely different now. Doctor Who's filming the scene in Manchester. Doctor Who exhibition is moving to Manchester. Any of those things it could be. But and it's like there's this evolution of it going in one direction, or in many other directions, and yet the basic crystallized in time moment of the original rumor persists and persists and persists, and it's quite an interesting thing. because it's a rumor is like, it's like a recording, isn't it?
Mm. No, it's like, well, I mean, it's a myth, isn't it? Essentially, it's a form of the myth. It's to some degree, it's not obviously got sort of social values within it, but it sort of operates in that same sort of way, that it sort of carries a sort of core meaning that then shifts and, as you say, can and alter depending on different groups who interact with it, with different different positions and looking for different meanings out of it. So yeah, I think it's quite interesting how they change and evolve. And sometimes they don't, because sometimes you do just turn around and they're all wearing eye patches.
Well, you know, the thing is as well, of course, that our listener was absolutely unprepared for anything that they've just heard. So perhaps we should get back onto the agenda, as it were. Doctor Who returns to television in 2005. Now, this isn't a Doctor Who podcast, but this is a podcast about what happened when Doctor Who returned to television in 2005, because it kind of, and to some extent, it affected American TV as well, but in a sort of a lower level, or impacted at a lower level. It kickstarted a new sort of urge for, and desire and demand, which is a word I was struggling for genre and fantasy TV, when there was very little of it about in 2005. So what I did, I hopped onto Facebook and also Twitter, but only had one response on Twitter, because apparently our 12,000 or so Twitter followers don't respond very often. Don't know why that is. But Facebook, we love you guys. So basically, I said, for an upcoming podcast, what has been your favourite TV show since Doctor Who returned in 2005? It might be Doctor Who, or it might be Life on Mars, Ripper Street, Heroes, Agent Carter, Gotham, Game of Thrones, anything really since 2005. And there's such a nice wide selection of suggestions and loves for these TV shows. Now, on the one hand, you know, the reasons behind Doctor Who coming back are sort of like, you know, it's been gone into before, but I think the strength of the writing that first series and how they revived the show and made it compelling viewing for Saturday night in a slot which was, well, pretty much how Saturday nights are now, stayed dull, average, below average. You know, there's very little to stay in for. It's pretty much a dead slot. And how that turned around and how, like, all these things split up from it. So, for instance, we've got Jonathan Appleton, who was one of our contributors on castoverage.com back in the day. He loved Being Human. More recently thought The Handmaid's Tale was terrific. Paul Fricker says Life on Mars. Samuel Grieve says Breaking Bad. Katie Poole, The Shadow Line, which I've missed, but that's a Christopher Eccleston series with Chiwetel Ejiofor and Leslie Sharp, which I want to catch up with at some point soon. What else have we got? We've got The 7:39 with Sheridan Smith and David Morrissey. There's a lot of Doctor Who links through all of these as well. There's also mentions of Robin Hood and Atlantis, which I think there's some kind of debate as to how good they were compared with, say, Merlin. So it's very good to see lots of nice suggestions here. What do you have a particular favourite thing that isn't Doctor Who since 2005?
Well, I mean, I think the only thing I would say, I think, because some of those American shows.
Yeah, well, it doesn't really matter.
No, I know. I was going to say, I think from 2005, there was a change, as you say, for British drama culture.
Yeah.
It was probably following on from some of the sort of energies that were sort of circulating around America. You know, obviously Buffy was a massive influence on Russell T. Davis. Mm-hmm. There's things like Farscapes and obviously done old Star Trek, sorry. but you know, I think you're right. I mean, 2005 is a nice point to actually look and just say, what has there been since that sort of moment? We've probably sort of mixed in with sort of Web 2.0 sort of really making its moves forwards in terms of different ways of how people socialized and mixed messages and communicated and converged as fans. Yeah, I mean, the ones on the list that have been said there, Life on Mars, I think, was a particularly powerful one for me, which had me thinking a lot and talking a lot, and then finding very few people.
Well, I think the Life on Mars one as well, just for a little sidetrack, the Life on Mars thing, I think, has a... I don't know if you don't read 14 Times, do you?
No.
If any of our listeners do, I don't know if Bob Fisher is one of our listeners, but hello, Bob. Bob Fisher, the broadcaster here in the northeast of England, he's also a writer. He wrote a book about sci-fi conventions called Before Leave It to Fall. He wrote an article on hauntology in a couple of issues ago in 14 Times, which is this kind of... It's a bit of a difficult concept to explain, but it's basically like elements of the past sort of still scaring the bejesus out of you, basically. And I think Life on Mars taps into that quite well.
But I think it also taps into a desire for the past as well. It's a sort of interesting conflict, which is obviously played out in the narrative, but as you say, as viewers... For viewers who might have experienced either the back end of the 70s or certainly remember seven shows which were still floating around in the 80s that were on the 70s, there is that sort of mixture of nostalgia, simplicity.
Like us.
I mean, sometimes I horrendously miss the simplicity of pre-internet times.
Do you know what I do for a living, and maybe the listener does or doesn't. I'm a technology writer. I agree completely with James on this. Although I seem to get along quite well with technology, I do miss the days of, you know, just picking up a remote control that has a little soundy thing in it to turn the telly over, and that's as high tech as the day got.
Well, it changes everything, doesn't it? It changes whole cultural consumptions and values, and, you know, I mean, like has been joked many times before, Sunday you would actually probably watch Bullseye because there was nothing else to watch. And because of that sort of lack of quality and lack of choice gave you such a different era of consuming television. Yeah. Things obviously had sort of more specialness to it, even though they weren't very good.
And it was usually as well, the thing about Bullseye or whatever was on a Sunday afternoon, that would be kind of you know, because, you know, it's got a reputation. People still remember it, thanks to Peter Kay and stuff. But it wasn't very good television even then. And, you know, it would have to be really bad weather for you to want to stay in and watch Bullseye.
No, you never really tuned in because you wanted to. But
exactly,
again, it's that whole assertion that your shows only had to be marginally less shit than the shows which were on the other side. That was the way that you sort of... I think it was a wonderful TED Talk which pushed that point, and it was very true. That was sort of like the way that you had to be. Then suddenly, when things become sort of more narrow-casted and you're not having to sort of just capture broad audiences, and you're getting people actually tuning in because they want to bloody well see something specific, which is good, then you have the whole quality television change. And obviously that is something... Certainly from the 2000s, early 2000s onwards, and obviously a bit before, but quality television really started to make its grounding. And quite interesting that very few of those shows listed are probably what would be defined as quality television in a lot of ways. But I think anything that makes you think, and Life on Mars, and especially how that went into Ashes to Ashes and how Ashes to Ashes sort of resolved it and what that meant, you know, retrospectively, and clearly not intended, even though they... Part of the Twin partnership said it was, part didn't said it wasn't. It makes it a very interesting thing. Obviously, things for me, topically, Twin Peaks has been a fascinating run that's just finished. It's series coming back after 25 years, which in itself, again, is a, like Doctor Who, has fascinating implications in terms of how does the show pitch itself, how does it change, how does it stay the same. So, yeah, I never got into the Robin Hood, Atlantis, Merlin stuff. Never watched them.
The Robin Hood thing was interesting when it first started. I think it's suffered with some of the... It got a bit of a Doctor Who treatment, getting moved about the schedules a little bit on the Saturday night. And then, of course, it wasn't supposed to end when it ended. But Jonas Armstrong, who later turned up in the last series of Ripper Street, didn't want to do any more. So they were going to recast it in a kind of Robin of Sherwood sort of a way, mm-hmm. with a new character who was Robin's half-brother. But for some reason, and they lined it up within the final few episodes of the series, and then they didn't go with it. They didn't commission it, which was kind of strange, I thought, to go to that effort to do that and then, you know, not follow it through. But
well, there's some very fascinating things going on at the moment with television and why things get cancelled or why things get that stay on, which has obviously a lot to do with streaming. Well, no, not necessarily streaming. Yeah, to some degree, it's but subscription culture.
Yeah.
Where things like Twin Peaks didn't do very well ratings, but as a subscription portal, as a gateway to a subscription service, subscriptions went very nicely up for CBS, I think it is, who owns Showtime. But the Showtime subscriptions increased very nicely, and they were very happy with that. Likewise, from what I understand, Star Trek Discovery is one of those which, again, is considered a loss, could be a loss leader, in that it doesn't have to be making it. It's not about it making money back. It's not about it. It's not about how it sells to other places after, because it's meant for CBS Online initially. Mm. It's about that, again, it's about the fact that its name, its brand name, will bring people to get the subscription, and once they get the subscription, that opens them up to all the other shows. And so it's a different structure thing. So ratings and actual viewerships to some degree start to become far less important. You've got no advertisers to be really capitulating to, and you've got a different route of economic, different economic route of how, you know, to actually get people to subscribe is more important than how many people actually watch that show. It's what that show gives profile to your channel or to your subscription channel. So I think some really interesting things about what might go and what might stay in the future. So Twin Peaks may get another season. There's talk about whether that will happen or not, whether David Lynch would, but it didn't do very well in the ratings, but it did do very well as a subscription. As leading in subscriptions. So again, these are things to be wary about when we come down to those old things of, oh, ratings. And
well, you know, I do wonder if we're going to end up with just, like, you know, broadcast TV, the old style TV channels being just, I don't know, just completely themed, and then the drama is all going to be subscription based through Netflix or Amazon or whatever.
Well, I think there's going to be guys I speak to says that he reckons, and through the industry he reckons is acknowledged, that there is a sort of bubble factor going to happen where there will be a burst, and it won't obviously mean that linear television dies. It just simply means that the amount of channels will massively reduce, because it's just not a sustainable model to have so many shows that can't be watched by everyone, which therefore can't fulfill revenue advertising criteria to sustain.
Well, it's a funny thing, isn't it? You say that exact phrase, shows that can't be watched by everyone. If we rewind the clock 30 years or so, the shows on ITV that couldn't be watched by everyone. And what happened there? All the regions got unified into one.
Yeah. Yeah, which is what I think to some degree is what's been predicted, is that instead of having these massive remote satellite channels, that they will all start to fall apart, and then the bigger ones will centralize and pick up what they want, and it will sort of pull linear and maybe subscription, maybe that is under the same threat, I don't know. But yeah, so it's going to change how things are. But I mean, of the things you've said there, Ripper Street, obviously we keep meaning to talk about, is one that
definitely will soon. Yes.
I thought that was great. Gotham is a mixed one. I wouldn't say it's been a highlight. I've enjoyed watching the second season more than the first. I don't think it's something I would say really, I don't know. It doesn't quite work for me in the way that I would say that's something that's really blowing my mind. Battlestar Galactica, I thought was a brilliant.
And I missed that.
Which I thought was
To my sort of chagrin. There's one here. There's an excellent suggestion from Daniel Edwards, which I think, Game of Thrones aside, I'm in wholehearted agreement, and that is The Man in the High Castle.
I tried
certainly
that.
Series 1 in particular is very good. Series 2 takes things in a different direction. By the end of Series 2, you're feeling the actual might of the persisting Nazi empires. How did you find The Man in the High Castle then?
I just about got through the pilot and didn't go any further with it.
Right, so. Okay.
It didn't do me. Preacher was interesting, again, as an adaptation, to see how they take a comic which doesn't really lend itself to adaptation and move that to television. They've made some very interesting choices there. Equally, again, Ash versus the Evil Dead, like Twin Peaks, something I never imagined I'd see.
Mm-hmm.
Again, an adaptation of an old franchise which had been considered not really financially viable at the time. And again, seeing how that adapts not just to television, but to the television that we have now. And I think that was done through Stars. Again, so you've got a subscription lock on that, as far as I'm aware, America side. So
that's Stars who did the final series of Torchwood, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get a sort of flexibility there again in what they can do in tone and content. So again, these are sort of quite interesting things which are not to do with Doctor Who, but like you say, you know, the early 2000s sort of signposts a change in television where television has been going. And to be fair, Battlestar Galactica was before Doctor Who, so
yes,
you just scrap that one off.
It's interesting, is it, that, you know, 11 years after it finished, we're still talking about Life on Mars.
I wish we talked about it more. There's a lot in that show,
yeah,
which is obviously interpretive, but I've found that the main core fandom I don't agree with, which is what always fascinates me. I mean, the main core fandom likes to talk about the Geneverse, which one of the writers sort of suggested that this was sort of held together through him almost, or that's how it's been interpreted,
yeah,
which I don't agree with. To me, this is and pretty much what the other writer says is what I agree with, which is what I got from the show, was that, you know, obviously if you've not seen Life on Mars, you really should have by now. It's been, what, 8 years since it finished, more maybe?
Well, like Ashes to Ashes, 10 years. Yeah. Yeah.
I said Life on Mars, Ashes to Ashes was about 2008, 2010, did it finish?
Yeah.
But point being, I kind of felt that this was more about a world which was that his personality imbued and gave a certain colour rather than him being the linchpin to everything there, which I think sort of undermines some of the connections in that show. So it's kind of interesting what people take out of these things and and what the leading voices as well in fandoms start to suggest, and often what leading voices are the ones which start to dictate, almost like rumours becoming truth or myths becoming fact, being reinterpreted and then sort of sometimes, not just in that, but in most fan communities, reinterpreted and then formed as sort of gospels, which is always quite an interesting thing. But yeah, Life on Mars, fascinating, and I've found it always fascinating because of what it actually suggests. Again, I'm trying not to spoil it for people too much who haven't seen it, but what it suggests, sort of what that sort of suggests for all shows on television, which I think is kind of an interesting thing, and sort of explains so many of the vices of television shows, so far as plot holes and actor changes, which suddenly, if you take it into the world of Life on Mars, they can be actually quite easily interpreted and make sense. So, yeah, Life on Mars is a fascinating one. And as you say, because it's so closely related to Doctor Who in sort of certain production levels, BBC castings, writers.
Yeah. I'll throw in a Life on Mars fact, seeing as how Gareth isn't here, but some of the scenes were filmed outside his old pub. And when I say his old pub, I mean the one he was not his watering hole, the one he ran in Manchester. So that's it's quite cool.
I always preferred Life on Mars to Ashes to Ashes, in the sense that I always felt that they put more effort in Life on Mars to make Manchester feel populated.
Yeah.
Where in Ashes to Ashes, I kind of felt there was a lot of early morning shootings of cars.
It's in London, isn't it? Yeah.
Shooting by, but I never really felt that there was that much scene setting.
I had trouble with the first series of Ashes to Ashes that I the first episode I didn't want to know about Keeley Hawes at all. I thought Alex Drake was absolutely terrible and overblown. And then I stumbled upon the final 10 minutes of the last episode several weeks later, and I thought, oh my god, what have I missed? So we got it on DVD from Love Film as soon as it was available, and watched it in two nights, and it was worth it.
the first series is inherently flawed, and it's not her fault. It's,
no, it's not. No, but once you get to that payoff at the end of the first series is so good.
But it's funny because when you listen to the writers talk about the pilot for Life on Mars, one of the things they say is that they needed the conceit of trying to get Sam into that world and part of that world as quickly as they could, and they kind of felt that they could push it about into the second act. It was about as far as they could go before they'd have to go, yeah, now we've got to find reasons to have him at least partially believe in this world,
sure,
and invest in it. But with Ashes to Ashes, they just kept playing this whole thing that she just wouldn't invest in into it. Each episode she would lord and sort of make these very sort of haughty comments about this being, you know, because her coming from being a profile. Was she a psychologist?
But she was something like that. Yeah, she knew about Sam Tyler. She'd read his file and everything, hadn't she?
Yes, so. And she was there. So therefore, she was extrapolating the ideas of this being some sort of delusion. But she could never escape that fact. And while Sam also often thought this, and it was obviously something that was a current thing, was a question of where was he and what was he doing. They sort of put him into that world and made him part of that world very early on, which they didn't do with Ashes to Ashes.
No.
And that was just really odd because it really made it hard to like her because she was constantly rejecting the world rather than just getting on with it, which is what the audience wants to see. They don't want to see her constantly getting drunk and complaining that this isn't the world as she wants it to be. She wants to, you know, there was a certain amount of friction that they created, which from the second season on of Ashes to Ashes, they very wisely removed and sort of found that same level as they'd been playing with Sam. So yeah, that first season, apart from that first episode, which was some good episodes in the first season, but that last episode has a real turnaround, which is, you know, brilliantly done, and hats off that they play a real gambit on their reveal throughout the season. Which again, we're not trying to spoil, but I remember watching it with family at the time, having seen it all the way through, sweating through that season, thinking, are they going to work out the reveal? The card is there in front of them. They're blatantly giving you the card, and you don't. And it's amazing to see people just twig exactly where the writers want them to twig.
Yeah.
Just before the reveal, so they feel the thrill of working out what's about to happen, but they can't carry the pride of knowing that they knew what was going to happen. It was a brilliant series, and probably sadly has sort of slightly got forgotten in its. It's one of those shows which I think, you know, in 20 years' time, people talk about it in the same way that people will talk about, you know, some of the 70s shows, like Survivors, maybe. You know, has critical backing to it, but no one really talks about it anymore. Not like Doctor Who.
Quite possibly, yes. I was going to go back as well, just the thing, because we mentioned Robin Hood and Atlantis, which was a big failure.
Mm.
And the Musketeers as well was kind of, although the Musketeers was a later time slot, it did feel as though it's from the same family. But the thing is, Merlin had its full run and its full storyline, didn't it? I mean, that was like a package that ran for, I think it was 5 series or something.
Yeah.
And I wonder what it is that worked with Merlin for it to get that lifespan that didn't work so well for Robin Hood or for Atlantis, which was the main replacement. I think that was a replacement for Merlin. Why did Merlin work and the other ones didn't? It's quite an interesting thing.
Well, Robin Hood did have a core following.
Yes, it did. It did run for a while, but it dropped off towards the end because for various BBC-related reasons, I think.
But Atlantis was... I mean, I only saw the first half of the first episode, and there was just so many running cliches through it.
Yeah, it felt cobbled. It felt as though they were trying to like throw in movie references or, you know, references to the legends or whatever at the same time as working out this guy traveling back in time and becoming whoever and introducing the characters. There was too much going on.
And it wasn't believable.
No.
In that sort of sense. I mean, he was running around, arrows and wounds being attacked, and he was still, there was just nothing that made me sort of convinced, well, what is this world meant to be? Is it meant to be serious? Is it meant to be, it didn't have the tone. I think the tone was just not there. And
yeah.
I think, especially when you're doing these sort of fantastic, I don't know whether you call it fantastic historicals, because I know Atlantis isn't per se, but it is considered to some degrees historical. I think they're very hard to actually do, to actually really find the tone, without them looking like they're just a load of people standing in a wood or in an exotic location, but still essentially a load of actors in an exotic location. Something that I think even things like Game of Thrones to some degree always has to be wary of and manages very well. I always find that weird, that I think sometimes it's harder to go into the past with fantasy and or action drama than it is to actually go into the future. Or somehow, you know, I suppose because space carries no structure to it in our, you know, it can be anything because we don't go into space really. You give it a little more freedom. As soon as you sort of go back to being Robin Hood, you're starting looking around and you're thinking, would they really be that clean, or would they their teeth be that good, or would they speak this? And there's a lot harder to actually. And then when your tone is something which is meant to be sort of not serious, so you're not doing something which is meant to capture the feeling or the perceived feeling of the time, you're doing something which is an adventure, then you've got that tone issue of how do you do that? How do you make it feel real without it feeling boring or too real? Where's the tone? And I think BBC productions have suffered a lot from that. Something which I think, as I say, Life on Mars did very well. I mean, while I've heard a lot of people, including people who were involved in the police in the 70s, saying that it didn't reflect the police of the 70s, it reflected the perception of the police that we have in the 70s, which is what I think everyone thought of and to some degree was the point of the whole thing. It's interesting that, I think our British grown stuff has had a bit of a hard time in trying to, I think a lot of the time it's finding the tone.
Yeah, there's a couple of things that haven't worked so well, which before we get on to one or two things that have. There was Primeval, obviously, on ITV, which I think kicked off the year after Doctor Who in 2006 with its dinosaurs in every episode, or monsters, or prehistoric monsters, or future monsters, or basically CGI monstrous creations vaguely based on dinosaurs. Later on as well, we've had something else that didn't work so well, and I've completely forgotten what it was, but it had Philip Glenister in it. Good Lord, what was that show called? It was an ITV show. So anyway, there's that one. And I think Zoe Tapper from Survivors was in it as well. And speaking of Survivors, there was another show that popped up from the BBC, Bone Kickers. Do you remember Bone Kickers?
I don't. I remember it, but I don't remember. I didn't see it.
It was from the Life on Mars team, Matthew Graham and Ashley Farrow. It starred Hugh Bonneville and Julie Graham, who was in Survivors. And it was, I tell you, it was about a team of archaeologists, but they were looking for kind of Indiana Jones style stuff. And it was that poor that on the popular Doctor Who website that I ran at the time, the word bone kickers became shorthand for shit. Unfortunately, it really did struggle to, it didn't have Life on Mars or Ashes to Ashes quality to it for some reason.
It's funny when you get that, because there was that Spook spin-off as well, which just toppled and crumpled and rolled under the desk somewhere, and then someone set fire to the desk, and that wasn't quite
nice. Was that the Code 9 one?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, which again had, you know, a lot of the core British writing talents that was sort of working around the time, and
Chris Chibnall, James Moran,
and just couldn't get it to work. So it's kind of, we do have a very weird culture, and I'm not sure what we do, which I don't know. There's just something in the tone of our stuff, which we seem to be very good at doing certain things and other things we don't. I don't know whether it's money, whether it's the length of our dramas, whether it's I don't know, but we don't often get that. Another one I thought was great, which we've talked about before, Whitechapel.
Oh, of course, Whitechapel.
Was a wonderful show.
Excellent, one of ITV's rare successes.
I was going to say, yeah, a rare win for
ITV's actual rare success. I think, two things that I'm particularly interested to sitcoms and fantasy, sci-fi fantasy genre TV. And the two things ITV seem to have got right in the last decade or so have been Whitechapel, and Vicious. We saw Derek Jacobi and Surrey and McKellen.
I quite enjoyed Prey. It was very
That was good, wasn't it, with John Sim?
I didn't see the Philip Glenister one, but I always kept my eye out for it.
I think I missed the end of the Philip Glenister one, but yeah, certainly the first one with John Sim was good as well. But so it wasn't really genre, though, was it? It was basically
we're jumping genre.
It was the Fugitive, wasn't it, basically?
Yes, absolutely. It was just a pure Fugitive model, but it was kind of interesting because these days the Fugitive model is very hard to work since we have so much surveillance and
methods
of detection, and our the way we use money and everything is just so it was just kind of interesting to see how they played with it. But yeah, I totally agree with you. I mean, Whitechapel was fantastic stuff, and it was just quite stunning that it lost its, well, not, I was not surprising, I guess, because it was getting darker and darker, and that was clearly just not sustainable for the ITV sort of entertainment vibe that they have, that sort of entertainment focus, which was a real shame because it just needed one more season, I think, to finish it off. It was going in really interesting directions. So if you've not seen Whitechapel, I think it's on Netflix. It's really worth watching. It's pretty dark. But
let's try and round this up, because obviously there's only us two here, so we can't really ask the listener the answer to this question, and there's only us two, so we might as well ask each other. So if I was going to say to you, take a British show, an American show since 2005,
a British or American,
and one British show, one American show, one of each.
And they'd have to go to a desert island.
Yeah, or an asteroid, or your back garden bomb shelter when North Korea attacked.
See, you've got to be careful here, because there would be certain ways to sort of circumnavigate this, isn't there, in the sense of which would have the most episodes. This is sort of, I'm going to go to desert island. Do I want to be carrying quality, or do I want to be carrying quantity?
Well, you're taking the novel adaptation, because there won't be any power on the desert island.
Okay. yes, true. So okay, well, you must have ideas. So while I'm thinking this, because you sprung it on me, what sort of ideas did you have?
For American show, I'm definitely going for Game of Thrones.
Right.
That's a dead cert for me. I think for the British show, it's a toss-up between Life on Mars and Ripper Street. I think I would probably edge... I'll edge towards Ripper Street, but I might be feeling nostalgic for my childhood, in which case I might go for Life on Mars.
I think I would go for Life on Mars. Ripper Street is beautifully done, as we'll talk about at some point, had a very strong ending, but it was quite a nihilistic ending in a lot of ways that I'm not sure whether repeat viewing would be something that I would leap to for repeat viewing. So maybe not that. I was... Life on Mars, I think, for the British. American is a little more difficult, maybe. I'm trying to think. I mean, Game of Thrones is obviously an obvious one, but it'd be nice to go for something different. From 2005, maybe Galactica, which has its ups and downs, but there's a lot going on there, which gives it a lot of rewatch to it. A lot of development, so might be, but then that was before 2005. So
yeah, it was 2004 that kicked off.
That's scuzzy. It's a word I've not used in a long time, or if ever.
I've never used it.
I'm trying to think of the American shows and there's been many that I've really enjoyed from start to finish. I mean, there's ones which should interest me. Falling Skies should be mentioned. Very good show up to the last season where it fell apart, so that's out the window.
Well, do you know, I mean, you know a lot more American TV than I do. If there was no Game of Thrones, and I would be tossing up, the first series of The Man in the High Castle with the first series of Heroes. So you're at an advantage to me because you've got a lot more to choose from. That you've seen.
Was the first series of Heroes before 2005 or after?
I think it was 2005-2006. And I'll have to look it up. I'm basing this on when I was working in a particular location. 2006 it started, did Heroes. around 2006, 2007, 2010 the first time.
Okay. So I'm just trying to think what other shows have been running after 2005, stateside science fiction that wasn't Galactica. I've been watching Babylon, well, I've been trying to watch Babylon 5, but I think I'm at a point now where my DVD discs are starting to disintegrate because they're not playing. That season one box set is not playing, which is vaguely worrying to say the least. Throw me some American stuff.
Well, as I did mention, I've watched an awful lot of American stuff over this. Star Trek Enterprise, Gotham. I don't know where some of the shows come from. So, is Vikings? I don't know where that comes from. Yeah, really struggling here.
Yeah, I'm just having a quick look. You see if the internet has. See Firefly 2002. Isn't that typical? I watched Westworld, which was very good.
Okay.
Although
that's on my to watch list.
It's a very quite a dark struggle. I don't know whether it's a rewatch one, but it was certainly one that I would recommend if you're looking at something that has a little depth to it. I've been watching Colony, which is fairly interesting as well. But I might actually have to agree with you, I'm afraid, and probably say Game of Thrones.
Okay.
It's a bit dull, but if we're going 2005 onwards, Expanse was very good, first season. Not seen the next one, so who knows where that's going to go. There's a lot of good shows out there, but for that sort of mixture, Orphan Black had a great first season, but then to me just got, you know, just started to go around the mill. I just need to check the date, but it's going to be in time. The Star Wars Clone Wars series, which I thought, yeah, which is pretty much my favorite Star Wars, full stop. So yeah,
well, you know, we can carry this on later on. We'll leave the conversation open for you, dear listener. You can comment after this podcast on Facebook, tweet us, or give us a ring. You haven't got my number, so it's tough, but you could always reply. I say give us a ring in inverted comments. You can audio boom us back, basically. Head to the audio boom page and record your own response to that, and then we'll hear that in response. Just let us know. There's no need to stop this now. We can come back to it in future. And hopefully James and I will also find the time to come back to Ripper Street in future as well. And maybe even do some Life on Mars commentaries. Who knows? That's the end for this time. We shall return. Until then, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Casterbrus podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCasterbrus.com.